John chapter 2. John chapter 2 is where we are. We only spent 3 weeks on John chapter 1, which seems ridiculous to me. John chapter 2, the story of the wedding at Cana. This is where we are. You should have turned there by now, hopefully. I should probably be turning there as well, too. As way of introduction, I want to talk about our reactions, our instinctual reactions. The way we react to things says a lot about us. Are you the kind of person that the initial gut reaction to anything, do you get angry? Do you get frustrated? Do you tend to just kind of go with the flow? How do you react when things go poorly? When there's maybe a problem at work, when there's a problem in your personal life, you get bad news, maybe it's a family member. You know, when you have these things that go on in our lives, what is your immediate initial reaction? Do you tend to get angry at somebody? Do you tend to get sad? Do you tend to get frustrated? Do you lash out? Do you keep it in? Are you one of those people that bottle their emotions? There's people like that too, right? Who their first reaction is keep it all in. How we react to a problem, to a situation, says a lot about us. When we first encounter a problem or situation, how do we respond? What is the first thing that you do? Just be thinking about this idea as we go through the lesson, because I think this is going to be a lesson that we can draw from this story in John chapter 2, our initial reactions to things. The story in John chapter 2, the story of the wedding, it's one of the more fascinating events in the life of Jesus. It's sort of disconnected, really. It's not in the other Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke. They don't tell this story. It's seemingly unconnected to his ministry. There's not really any teaching that goes along with this, right? All the other miracles of Jesus' life tend to be centered around some sort of teaching, some sort of teaching moment. Repent, for the kingdom of heaven is at hand. Yet this incident, this wedding at Cana, it's seemingly unconnected to his earthly ministry. It doesn't follow the pattern of the miracles throughout the rest of the Gospels that Jesus demonstrates. There's nobody hurting that he would need to be compassionate of. There's no teaching moment here. He's just doing a miracle seemingly for unknown reasons. It's very interesting, this story. And it is a fairly controversial story, not like really controversial, but sort of controversial among certain groups, and we'll talk about why that is. Let's look at the story in John chapter 2. John chapter 2, beginning in verse 1. On the third day, there was a wedding at Cana in Galilee, and the mother of Jesus was there. Why was the mother of Jesus there? Maybe this was connected to the family, a nephew or a cousin perhaps, I don't know. Jesus was also invited to the wedding with his disciples. It's interesting that his disciples are also invited. When the wine ran out, the mother of Jesus said to him, "They have no wine." And Jesus said to her, "Woman, what does this have to do with me? My hour has not yet come." His mother said to the servants, "Do whatever he tells you." Now, some context as we think about this wedding. Weddings were week-long affairs. This is not like a one-day thing. This is a prolonged, protracted celebration, a feast, right? This is a longer affair. Jewish weddings were not just sort of 4 hours and then you're done. One of the things the master of the feast, we'll see the master of the feast later on in the story, one of the things he was in charge of was making sure the guests had wine for the full 7 days. So you think about this week-long celebration, there's some logistical planning that needs to go in. How are we going to have food? How are we going to have wine? How are we going to have et cetera, et cetera, et cetera? You think it's hard to plan for a wedding that lasts 2 hours? Think about planning for a wedding that lasts a week. I mean, there's a lot of planning that goes into that. One of the jobs of the master of the feast was to make sure the guests had wine for the full 7 days. Now, the master of the feast did not buy the wine, which we'll see as we go on. He was just in charge of dispensing it, making sure that people weren't drinking too much or too little. There was a sweet spot there. We'll get into that more as we go on. It was customary for guests to help offset the costs of the wedding. And that makes sense. You're feeding people for 7 days. That's going to be a prohibitive cost. So it was customary for the guests of the wedding to pitch in, to help out, to offset the cost of the wedding, because you're eating with these people for this week-long celebration. A particular note in this story, is the phrase, "My hour has not yet come," right here, right? Woman, what does this have to do with me? My hour has not yet come. And this phrase is a particularly interesting one in the life of Jesus. John especially focuses on this idea of the hour of Jesus, the hour of his ministry. And Jesus knew, it seems, as we go in John chapter 2, it seems that Jesus knew that once he started down this path, there was no turning back. What path was that? The path of doing the miraculous, his earthly ministry. Okay, and it seems to that up until this point, he's probably led a fairly normal life. He's not been doing a bunch of miracles. He's just had a secular job, probably carpentry. Jesus the carpenter is a common idea. And up until this point, he's not yet made himself known. Nobody knows he's special. Nobody knows he's this son of God, except for perhaps Mary and whoever Mary's told, and John the Baptist, of course, at this point. But for the most part, his life has been fairly insulated. Just a normal guy doing normal guy things, living an ordinary life. And at this point, he knows probably, my hour has not yet come. The time to begin is not quite here. And yet he does indeed do the miracle, doesn't he? The ministry of Jesus followed a very specific timetable. I'm not going to read these verses, but I encourage you, John 7, verse 30, John 8, verse 20, and John 13, verse 1, the first two of those have to do with times when Jesus escaped, that the Pharisees were trying to catch him or the authorities were trying to arrest him. And both of those, he escaped. Why? Because his hour had not yet come. The time was not yet right for him to be arrested and crucified. And then finally in John 13, 1, they do kind of catch up with him because the hour has come. The ministry of Jesus followed a very specific timetable. Things had to happen in order at the appropriate time. And there's a lot of reasons for that. One of the reasons is prophecy, the fulfillment of prophecy. The other is he needs to reach a certain saturation point of his disciples. He needs to teach his disciples all the things they'll need to know for when he ascends and they take over the work of the kingdom. So there's a number of reasons for this. And this wedding at Cana, as Mary comes to him, Jesus, you need to fix this problem. Woman, this doesn't have anything to do with me. And this is what I say. The wedding at Cana, it seems unconnected to his ministry. It doesn't have anything to do with the teaching of the kingdom and the repentance and the healing miracles. It's just sort of over here while all the rest of the ministry stuff's over here. It's an unusual story. John 2, 6 through 10, as we keep reading. Now there were six stone water jars there for the Jewish rites of purification, each holding 20 or 30 gallons. Jesus said to the servants, fill the jars with water. And they filled them up to the brim. And he said to them, now draw some out and take it to the master of the feast. This is the guy we've talked about already. So they took it. And when the master of the feast tasted the water, now become wine, and did not know where it came from, though the servants who had drawn the water knew, the master of the feast called the bridegroom and said to him, everyone serves the good wine first. And when people have drunk freely, then the poor wine, but you have kept the good wine until now. Interesting story, interesting miracle. Why did he do it? It is an unusual miracle. It's not anything different than what has appeared in Scripture before, right? The changing of one thing to another is within the wheelhouse of God. Have a substance and turn it into another substance. We could think about the water to blood, right? In the Old Testament, this is something that's happened before. The transforming of materials. And if the transformation, water to wine, wasn't enough, the wine that Jesus created was apparently quite good. And I don't know the classification of what makes a wine good, but whatever it was, the master of the feast recognized, man, this is the good stuff. So in addition to making wine out of water, he didn't make some cheap knockoff wine. This was high quality stuff here. And the question that keeps coming up as I read the commentaries preparing for the lesson, did Jesus make alcoholic wine? This is the question that kept coming up. And as we think about this story, I'm going to talk briefly about it, but I do want to note, this is not the point of the story. Whether or not Jesus made wine that was alcoholic or not is beside the point of the story in John. John doesn't deal with the question at all. In John's mind, it doesn't even matter. He doesn't mention it whatsoever. And at face value, there's no good reason to think it wasn't alcoholic. That's the default. By default, wine had alcohol because they didn't have any good way of preserving beverages that weren't fermented. They didn't have refrigeration like we have refrigeration. So the fermentation process of the beverages was a way of preserving them for a longer period of time. A couple notes about this before we move on. The average proof was much lower than it is now, the alcohol content. It wasn't like things we have now. We specifically ferment things for a specific alcohol content, which they just didn't do then. Wine like this was very watered down, especially at weddings. Remember what's happening. This wine needs to last a week, okay? This is not just one meal and then you're done, but the master of the feast was in charge of dispensing this wine for a prolonged period of time. So they watered it down quite a bit. They just did as a way of making it go a little bit further. And because this was a Jewish wedding, it was very frowned upon to get drunk. Okay, that was socially the social faux pas. You're not supposed to do that. This is a wedding. Don't get drunk. Enjoy the wine, and it's great. And maybe there was too many people. Maybe they had more people than they expected. Maybe he was passing it out too freely. I don't know what the problem was. But this is, as we think about this question, but really, why do people ask the question at all? Why do people ask, was the wine alcoholic? Does it matter really in the story? No. Doesn't matter for the purposes of John and what he's trying to tell. So why do people ask? Don't they ask because of the commandments in the New Testament not to get drunk? And we could read those commandments. We're not going to spend a lot of time on that. But I would encourage you to read those commandments in the New Testament and note that those commandments have much more to do with the quantity of drink than the drink itself. Do not get drunk, do not drink much wine, is not given freely to wine. In fact, in Timothy, Paul says, add some wine to your diet. Beside the point. Ultimately, it doesn't matter what Jesus created. It just doesn't matter. Okay, alcoholic, non-alcoholic, John doesn't bring it up because John doesn't think it's central to the point of the story. What is the point of the story? The wine was high quality and it was miraculous. That's what John cares about. It appeared seemingly out of nowhere, transforming water into wine. It's a miraculous event. And John takes the time to point out that this is not some cheap knockoff wine, but this is high quality. So not only did Jesus have miraculous powers, but the things that Jesus does are high quality. Accept no substitute standard. Even if it was alcoholic, which is a more likely scenario, and even if the guests had gotten drunk off of this wine, which is unlikely given the context, we often misassign blame or guilt anyway. So what if the people had gotten drunk off the wine that Jesus made? Is that Jesus' fault? They're the ones that made the choice to get drunk. God made a lot of things in the universe that man abuses. God made the ability for weapons, the ability for drugs, the ability for X, Y, or Z, put what you want to put in there, that men abuse. Does that mean God is at fault for our choices? No. It's our choices. What's the point of the miracle anyway? John chapter 2, verse 11. And this, the first of his signs, Jesus did at Cana in Galilee and manifested his glory. What glory? What glory is he talking about? Isn't this the glory that John describes in John chapter 1? And verse 14, and the word became flesh and dwelt among us, and we have seen his glory. Glory is of the only Son from the Father, full of grace and truth. Okay, this miracle was done to make known, to manifest, to make understandable the glory and the power and the majesty of Christ. That I am the Son of God and I have power over nature. I can do what I want. The laws of physics do not bind me. The laws of nature are not my master. I am their master because I created them. Isn't that the point of the miracle? To manifest his glory? And the secondary point, and his disciples believed in him. This miracle is not a teaching moment. Nowhere in this story do we have any teaching at all. Jesus is not teaching about whether or not we should get drunk. Jesus is not teaching the importance of weddings. Jesus is not teaching about what it means to this X, Y, or Z. What is the point of the miracle? Jesus is about to embark upon 3 years of teaching and persecution and being chased out of towns and being hated and also doing some amazing things, healing and teaching about the kingdom and teaching about what it means to really live under the old law, the fulfillment of the old law. He needs his disciples on board. These people are going to be with him for 3 years, and eventually, these people are going to be the ones to take his place when he ascends. When I ascend, you guys are going to have to do the work. I need you on board fully 100% before we begin. This miracle was for them. Believe who I am, because things are about to get bumpy. Isn't that what he says to Nathanael? You will see greater things than these. So this miracle, the point of this miracle was to show who Jesus was, primarily for the benefit of his disciples. Believe in me, I have power over nature. I have power over the universe. I am not bound as you are by the laws of physics. I have dominion over them. And in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, the temptation serves as the launching point of his ministry. It's interesting to me, the arrival of the hour, my hour has not yet come, the temptations is that marker in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, as that's the beginning point. And they don't talk about this story. In John, this is the launching point. This is the beginning of his ministry as he's going to go on. And note, let's note here one more final time, Jesus did not grow up doing the miraculous. What does it say? It's very clear. This, the first of his signs. The first. What does that mean? That means he didn't do anything before this. There weren't other signs before this that he did. Now, his birth was a miraculous sign, right? But he didn't do that. That was really Mary and God. Jesus didn't do that at all. So there were things about him and his birth, the miraculous circumstances of his birth, that did point to Jesus. But Jesus did not grow up as a child smiting people left and right because they stole his ball. He was just a boy, a normal, ordinary human being. So when we read these, and there's some non-canonical, extra-biblical books that claim to describe the life of Jesus, and they contain his miracles as a boy and as a child doing all these things, I'm inclined not to believe them, primarily because they contradict this idea that this was the beginning of his miraculous works. So what can we learn from this story? What is the point for us? Why did John include it in his gospel? Again, serving as the identity of who he is, another proof and evidence of his ability. It is important for his disciples, as we'll go throughout the narrative. They need to believe in who he is. So what can we learn from this story? I think we learn the most from Mary. We don't learn a lot from Jesus in this story, other than that he has got this supernatural power. We really learn the most from Mary in this particular problem. And remember our first point. How we react says a lot about us. When we are faced with a problem, a difficulty, a circumstance, whatever it may be, how we react to that problem says a lot about what we believe, what our ideals are, what our morals are, how we think about the world. A lot of that is wrapped up in our response to crisis. How did Mary react to the problem? Oh, we've ran out of wine. Hey, let's go find Jesus. Jesus can figure it out, right? How did Mary react to Jesus' dismissal? Woman, what has this to do with me? My hour has not yet come. Did Mary argue? Was she upset? No, she said, whatever he tells you to do, do it. She accepted his statement at face value. Okay, and Jesus, as he dismisses Mary, it's interesting. He dismisses Mary, but then he goes on and does the miracle anyway. Yet Mary trusts whatever he does, it'll be fine. Okay, first, her first reaction, let's go find Jesus. He can fix the problem. Second thing is, whatever Jesus says, she accepts. Okay, just do whatever he says. It's not up to me. I'm not the one in charge. I'm not the one with the answers. How did Mary react to the miracle? We don't really get to know. It's interesting to me. We don't really get to know her reaction to this. Now, she must have been satisfied, right? Because she got what she wanted. She got the thing that she was seeking, this resolution to the problem. And yet we don't really get to know her reaction. Jesus does what he does for his own reasons. And you kind of get the impression he doesn't do it for Mary. He doesn't do it because Mary wants him to. He does it because this is what he needs to do for his own ministry and for his proof for his disciples. And this is what happens in our own lives. A lot of times God responds to our prayers, and maybe we get what we want, maybe we don't. But we need to recognize that God does what he does for his own reasons, and they are better than our reasons. Okay? Our reasons why we want things, they're okay and they're fine, but God has a better plan. So when God does what he does, part of trusting in God is accepting the answer, whatever it may be, and even if we get what we want, being thankful for it, but recognizing that there may have been another reason why God did what he did. It's not just about my desires. This miracle, John, in John chapter 2, Jesus does what Mary wants, but you kind of get the sense that he doesn't do it for Mary. He does it for who? For his disciples, that they might believe. So as we think about the application for us, when we encounter problems, is Jesus the first place we turn or the last? Oh, I've got this problem at work. Do we ever bring Jesus into that at all? And I kind of fear, I hope this isn't the case, but I fear that it is, that Jesus is the last resort. We've exhausted all financial avenues, and we've exhausted personal avenues and social avenues, and we've exhausted the internet, the vast research of the internet, and Jesus is the last place we go for help. What does that say about our relationship with Jesus? What does that say about how we trust and rely upon him? You get the sense in the story, Mary finds out the problem, and her first thing, well, let's go find Jesus, he can fix it. There's a trust there. There's a reliance there. Is Jesus the first person you go to, or the last, or somewhere in the middle? And if it's somewhere in the middle, who is taking the place of Jesus in your reliance? Do we trust his ability to help us, whatever it is, even if we don't like how things are going? Again, the answer that Jesus gives Mary is not particularly encouraging to Mary. Woman, what does this have to do with me? Why are you asking me about this? What are you even doing, woman? Okay, it's not particularly encouraging to Mary, but she trusts anyway. Whatever he says, do it. Even if we don't like how things are going, even if it's not our first or second or third choice, do we trust that Jesus knows what he's doing or not? Even when it may be that things are going in a way we don't like. Or do we just want it to be all on our timetable with our ideas, with our understanding? And then if Jesus doesn't do exactly the thing that I want when I want it, then I'll stop relying on him. Well, that's not a biblical attitude. Finally, the question, do you believe in Jesus like the disciples did after this miracle? Let's read it one more time. John chapter 2, verse 11. This, the first of his signs Jesus did at Cana in Galilee and manifested his glory, and his disciples believed in him. Fundamentally, that's the question you've got to ask. And the reason this story is in the Gospel of John, I think, is much more about the reaction of the disciples to this miracle, that they believed in who he was. Do we believe that Jesus is who he said he was? And do we believe that Jesus will do the things that he's promised to do? And lo, I am with you always, even to the end of the age. I go to prepare a place for you, that where I am, there you may be also. Do you not know that he will return in a manner like he ascended? Do we believe in those promises of Jesus? My invitation, my encouragement is this. When you have problems, when you have difficulties, make Jesus your first stop. Go to him first, not last. Don't let him be the leftover. Make him the first priority. Jesus, help me with whatever it is in my life. And whenever you get your answer, the things, the way things are going, if you trust Jesus, trust that what is happening is with a reason. Maybe it's not the reason you want, but God does have his reasons for doing things. And believe and trust that Jesus can help you.